Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Oxfam launch of the new climate change report. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. Please note I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It's now my pleasure to turn the call over to Mr. Ray Offenheiser. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning. This is Ray Offenheiser. I'm the president of Oxfam America. I'd like to thank our commentators as well as members of the press for joining us this morning for the launch of the Oxfam-supported report entitled Exposed Social Vulnerability and Climate Change in the Southeast United States. I'd like to just suggest that as the speakers are delivering their remarks, those of you in the press might want to join us online to take a look at the interactive maps that are accompanying this report, and you can do that very easily at www.oxfamamerica.org/ADAPT, or ADAPT. ADAPT. So you can get the maps that our speakers will be referring to online, so you can be following along in the conversation, looking at those maps, and it might help you get a better grip on the content that we're going to be discussing this morning. Very briefly, a quick introduction to Oxfam. Oxfam America is an international development and humanitarian organization. We work with communities and partner organizations in more than 100 countries around the world to create lasting solutions to poverty, hunger, and social injustice. Our staff are on the front lines of the climate change challenge, and they've been reporting to us with alarming frequency the disastrous consequences of increased climate variability. And this experience is beginning to tell us that although they are least responsible for climate change, it's really the poor that are going to bear the brunt of climate change impacts. Whether it be melting glaciers in Tajikistan to extended droughts across Africa, which we're seeing with greater frequency, and as well as frequent flooding in South and Southeast Asia, climate change is something that we have to come to terms with and realize that it's happening right now, and it's making the lives of poor people more and more precarious. But climate change is not just a faraway problem in terms of time nor distance. Its effects are being felt not only in Bangladesh but also in Biloxi, Mississippi, as we saw with Katrina and Rita. Historically, studies about climate hazards have existed separate from studies on social vulnerability, and that's why we put together this report. Oxfam America commissioned this study as the first of its kind to examine both the potential impacts of climate change-related hazards and the social and demographic characteristics of the populations which are most at risk. While social variables such as income, gender, or age do not necessarily determine when, where, or who will be hit by a climate-related disaster, they do influence a community's ability to prepare for, respond to, and recover from disasters. The report, authored by Drs. Cutter and Emrich at the University of South Carolina, is a groundbreaking study that pinpoints socially and economically vulnerable communities that are most vulnerable to climate change risks, with the idea that it will enable decision makers to better assess and target investments and prepare communities to become more resilient in the face of those climate-based challenges. Action on climate change, I think we would all agree, is urgent because so many communities have little ability to prepare for and recover from climate-related disasters. Reducing our greenhouse gas emissions is a fundamental part of the long-term solution. But we've got to remember that helping communities adapt to the changing climate by building climate resiliency and preparedness is imperative in the short term. Without such action, we're likely to see a downward spiral of deeper poverty and increased vulnerability in these kinds of communities. So, to discuss the findings of this report, I want now to turn the conversation over to Chris Emrich, the co-author of the report, to summarize its findings. And as I mentioned before, you can follow the presentation or his presentation online at www.oxfamamerica.org/adapt, where the maps that are at the heart of the report can be found. So, Chris, let me turn it over to you now.
Thank you, and good morning. The Hazards and Vulnerability Research Institute was approached by Oxfam because of our extensive understanding related to the science of vulnerability, our strong background in performing such studies, especially in the Southeast United States, and our consistent use of scientific and statistical methods that are peer-reviewed in the applications that we produce and in the processes of our research projects. We accepted this challenge from Oxfam because we felt that our mission interests closely paralleled those with Oxfam, and we wanted to help develop tools and technologies that would provide an evidentiary basis for identifying vulnerable populations related to climate change hazard potentiality. Specifically, the breadth and depth of this project make it a groundbreaking work for not only the HVRI or the Institute, but also for Oxfam, and we're really excited about the opportunity to help create a tool for use in climate change planning, from the basic family level all the way up to the federal level, which can help in decision support, mitigation, and prioritization of goals and focus. Specifically, the Social Vulnerability Index, or SOVI, was fundamentally originated in the academic field of hazards geography starting in the 1960s and 1970s. Since then, it's been utilized by many states and sub-state entities for the identification of vulnerable subgroups. From the perspective of vulnerability, this project reflects a rather large advance in the science and the application of the SOVI metric. Essentially, this project focuses on who, where, and why related to social vulnerability. By coupling social vulnerability with the geographic understanding of the biophysical or the risk-based threats, we identify which people or who are being threatened by which hazards, as well as identifying the why or the underlying socioeconomic and demographic conditions that are in a place that give rise to adverse impacts from hazard events such as flooding, drought, hurricane force winds, and sea level rise. Social vulnerabilities, broadly defined, are those pre-existing conditions which differentially influence a person, families, communities, localities' ability to prepare for, respond to, cope with, adapt, and recover from environmental hazards, both human-induced and naturally occurring. The index utilizes 39 different socioeconomic, demographic, work-related, and housing characteristics that we culled from over 250 original variables that are well-known correlates of vulnerability from the peer-reviewed literature. These variables are analyzed using a principal components data reduction method, which groups variables based on their coexistent explanatory power and creates a number or a social vulnerability score for each geographic unit of interest. In this case, that unit of interest is counties or parishes. For the project, we classified these scores as high, medium, and low so that users could quickly identify patterns across the study area. Now, if you're on the website, www.oxfamamerica.org/adapt, A-D-A-P-T, please bring up the social vulnerability map so that you can start to familiarize yourself with the spatial representation of vulnerability across the landscape. As I said, these variables were boiled down into component parts of vulnerability. For the southeastern United States, these components were specifically 8 components: a wealth indicator, an age indicator, a race indicator, an ethnicity indicator, a rural indicator, a special needs indicator, a gender indicator, and an employment indicator. And we can get into the nuts and bolts of these a little bit later. But these 8 indicators combine to describe the vulnerability, the social vulnerability of an area. So if you're looking at the maps, make sure you pull up the social vulnerability map and that you're zoomed into the regional view. There are 3 patterns I'd like to discuss. The first pattern you can see is a broad pattern of social vulnerability identified by the dark green area in West Texas. In this area, vulnerability is largely a function of ethnicity, gender, age, and poverty. A second area I'd like you to focus on is the Mississippi River Valley area. You can see in the central part of the map another green, large green area. And this area is the vulnerability is a function of rural poverty, race, gender, and age. So you can see those 2 areas are the vulnerability is comprised of different things. The third area is kind of a more disparate area, and it's what we refer to as the Cotton Belt, and it runs from around Columbia, South Carolina, southward through central Alabama. And this the vulnerability in these areas varies based on spatial location and location related to major urban centers, and I'll talk a little bit about the urban-rural changes here in a minute. What's important to notice is that although each of these areas has high levels of vulnerability, they are not vulnerable for the same reasons. And we can start to look at these to target or focus our initiatives later on. And even though a county or parish may have a low vulnerability score, that does not necessarily mean that everyone in that county has low levels of social vulnerability. That's very, very important to remember. Also, the same holds true for the high vulnerability areas. Now, if you change your map view to the social vulnerability and all hazards map, this brings up a different view. And this is a view of combining social vulnerability with the potential incidence of hazards. These hazards we discussed, flood, sea level rise, drought, and hurricane force winds. Specifically, you want to look at areas shaded with a dark burgundy color. These areas represent a combination where we have high social vulnerability and high biophysical or hazard potentiality. These areas are labeled hot spots, and there are numerous across the study area, but generally found in two distinct areas. The first area that these places of these hot spots are found are highly urbanized and densely populated counties, which contain extremes of wealth, meaning very rich and very poor populations. The other kind of areas are the rural counties that contain mostly the disadvantaged and marginalized populations based on poverty, race, ethnicity, and gender. In the urban counties, all of them coastal, the general factors contributing to increased social vulnerability are varied. But it's important to note that in all cases except in one, Brownsville, Texas, the wealth factor reduces overall vulnerability, meaning that urban counties have a general reduction in vulnerability due to wealth rather than an increase in vulnerability due to poverty. In Orleans Parish, the factors that influence vulnerability are race, ethnicity, and special needs. So poverty and wealth don't necessarily play a part in social vulnerability for Orleans Parish as a whole. Social vulnerability in rural counties is a bit more homogenous, with poverty, race, and ethnicity, age, and gender defining increased social vulnerability in most cases. If you choose to zoom to Louisiana using your zoom function on your map, Iberia Parish, located in south central Louisiana, where we have a high hazard exposure combined with an elevated social vulnerability score, is largely governed by Hispanic populations with young children, race, and employment in extractive industries. Conversely, in Texas, if you zoom to Texas, Willacy County in southeastern coastal Texas, social vulnerability is contributed to by ethnicity, as in the percent of Hispanic populations, children, and poverty. Now, if we want to, we can zoom to Alabama and look at Greene County, Alabama. Greene County is located in the west central portion of the state, and vulnerability here is a function of race, rural agricultural residents, and poverty. The reason I talk about these three different places is because we have to understand that vulnerability is formed in different places by different things. Now, while the hotspots provide a great starting point in the identification of the most socially vulnerable and most at risk, the formulation of specific mitigation, planning, community education, job creation, and other techniques can be aided by looking at different set of vulnerability and hazard identifiers. So if you'll please zoom to the state of Florida so I can provide you with some more insight into these different identification techniques. Once you're zoomed to the state of Florida, you'll notice that, first off, Florida does not have any red counties. What this indicates is that no counties which have a high social vulnerability have anything lower than a high hazard potential. It's very important to note. What you do see is a large number of dark blue and light blue counties. All of these counties have a high hazard potential, meaning they're greatly influenced by flooding, sea level rise, drought, and hurricane force winds, but they have either a low to moderate social vulnerability. In these dark and light blue areas, we would want to focus on mitigation, structural mitigation techniques aimed at reducing hazard potential. Now, if you choose to zoom to Georgia, I can give you a different look at the same data. Once you zoom to Georgia, you'll get a good picture of central Georgia and central Alabama. At this level, you see a large number of dark and light red counties, including the Mississippi River Valley and the area surrounding Atlanta. These indicate areas where higher social vulnerability coincides with low to moderate levels of hazard vulnerability. In areas like these, we can reduce impacts by focusing more on the human dimensions to change vulnerability through education, job creation, increasing awareness, fostering adaptation, etc. To conclude, this study and the data provided in this website should be utilized to gain a better geographic understanding of the landscape of social vulnerability to climate change hazards. It provides scientifically based information for policymakers, planners, community leaders, advocacy groups, and the general public, which will better inform local knowledge and can, su- and can support real action in response to climate change. I argue that the first step towards changing the outcomes related to social vulnerability and the impacts of climate change is to know where we stand. This report and the features on this website provide the evidentiary knowledge about our current situation. It's up to individuals, groups, and stakeholders to call upon elected officials from local to federal to support quick and decisive actions to combat the impacts of climate change, especially those related to the most vulnerable populations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris, and for that very detailed presentation. We're now going to turn to Reverend Tyrone Edwards of Zion Travelers Cooperative Center, who has been a remarkable leader for his rural community at one of the southernmost points in Louisiana and just steps away from a 20-foot levee that was crested during Hurricane Katrina. And I think it's important to say that nearly all of his community's homes were destroyed or damaged in the storm, and some were never actually even found again. And Reverend Tyrone has been working tirelessly with his community ever since to try to restore the community and help people get back home. So, Reverend Tyrone, do you want to say a few words?
Yes. Thank you for welcoming us here to be a part of this historical gathering. We want to thank Oxfam for commissioning this report because I think it was very needed for people around the country to understand what's happening in rural communities like Plaquemine Parish. And I think the doctor did an excellent job of explaining it, but I have to go back home this afternoon and still witness some of the hazardous stuff that we face, because we face flood, hurricane, wind, and sea level. Just after Hurricane Gustav, we still have water on the road still left from Gustav that we have to see every day. So we had hazards before Katrina. Hazards still remain. We know that we were social vulnerable issues, lack of resources, poor community, lack of resources existed. Now, we have rebuilt most of our community, but we still are threatened by all the hazardous stuff. And I don't see them as being pretentious, as existing in hazard, because we still have high waters in a lot of our community. So we think this report is an excellent tool to not only help the government, but even help our community be more aware and be motivated to be a part of climate change, because we have a future generation. 40 years from now, Plaquemine Parish could be just water. So I think it helped motivate all of us, those of us who are advocates, to understand how this is a problem we as a community must be conscious of every day. So we are very thankful for that, because we are struggling, and we think this will help us with our policymakers to understand the need to really look at climate change and really be doing something about it very seriously, because it's affecting the lives of future generations. So we are very thankful for Oxfam for doing this report.
Great, great. Thank you, Reverend. I'd now like to turn to Mary Wilson, an accomplished attorney and president of the League of Women Voters, who will speak about the experience of women in the face of climate change.
Thank you, Ray. It's my pleasure to be with you on the call this morning. This is a very important report that has just been issued on social vulnerability and climate change. The League of Women Voters, for those of you who may not be familiar with our organization, has been around for 90 years. We started as a result of women getting the right to vote and feeling that this new cadre of women voters, and as it turned out, all voters, needed information about the public policy issues that were so important in elections. And the climate change issue is truly one of those issues that the League of Women Voters has taken on over the last few years to try to bring not only education and advocacy to our government officials who are in a position to make a difference, but also to the public, and to get the public to participate in this important policy-making decision process on how we go about stopping the adverse effects and adapting to the adverse effects of climate change. And this report really brings forth to us the vulnerability that women face. They have the effects of climate change and the weather events that result from the climate change issues really adversely affects women and children much more severely than other populations. And this report points that out so eloquently. We hope that this report can certainly be used not only to help educate our elected officials about the need for emergency planning amongst populations that are made up of poor single mothers in many cases. For those of you who aren't familiar with the fact that within the city of New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, over 83% of poor single mothers were displaced. That just highly illustrates the adverse effect that climate change issues have on women. And we're seeing that all across the Southeast with respect to this report and this vulnerable population. Women are, after all, the heads of households in a large number of these areas. They are very often in poverty situations. They're very often in minorities. And so they're hit by a number of different factors that make them the most vulnerable and the most in need of good, solid information about how climate change really affects their population. Many people who are socially vulnerable are not in a position and don't have the luxury of time to go out and study the effects. All they know are they're suffering from the loss of their housing, the loss of their job, the loss of child care facilities. And so it's up to all of us to make sure that the socially vulnerable populations, such as women, understand that these effects are coming because of climate change, and to increase the advocacy within women, because after all, women need to be at the table when these public policy decisions and emergency planning is made. They're the ones that are going to have to adapt to the changes that climate change brings. So we are especially delighted to see this report, which brings home to all of us the fact that socially vulnerable populations are so severely adversely affected by climate change events. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary. What I'd like to do now is turn to Benjamin Todd Jellis, president of the NAACP, for his comments and reactions to the report. Ben?
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here with you all. You know, when the thermometer goes up when waters rise, poor communities, working communities, are most at risk. And black people and people of color tend to be disproportionately represented in these places. We, you know, if there's a lesson from Katrina that every community can learn, it's that you have to be prepared. You have to have a plan for mobilizing and evacuating your entire community if you're facing a flood, if you're facing a hurricane, a tornado, an earthquake. And the reality is that in many communities across the country, most communities, we just don't have those plans. We, you know, are fighting over, you know, in Congress over profits for a few big companies when it comes to cap and trade and climate change legislation. But in the meantime, we're tolerating attacks on poor people's lives and working people's lives that, you know, is structured through neglect of really the first priority of any local community, any government, any county government, any state government, which is to protect the lives of their citizenry. And we at the NAACP unfortunately get called in, you know, on the heels of each disaster to make sure that Homeland Security, to make sure that the Red Cross find all of the communities, our local volunteers who are concentrated throughout the Southeast. We're about 1,200 communities across the country, about 400 or 500 throughout the Southeast, play a key role in making sure that those resources are distributed fairly and quickly. We've just launched a climate change program. In fact, our climate change director started yesterday because we've got to get ahead of the problem. Part of that is fighting to make sure that climate change legislation is passed. But part of that is just making sure that local communities are prepared, that they no longer should need us to come in there and tell them where the black nursing home that is not on their map is. Rather, they should have a plan that includes every community, incorporated and unincorporated. They should know exactly how they're going to mobilize folks. They should know, where are the areas where people are least likely to have cars and most likely to need assistance getting out. And they should make sure that if people who can't get out have a safe place to go. I am haunted by the experience of returning to the Gulf Coast, an area I used to cover as a reporter just a few weeks after Hurricane Katrina, and seeing a homeless shelter that had been a safe place where people gathered there in Biloxi to wait out the hurricane, a building that was comprised of cinder blocks and everybody thought could withstand the storm, reduced to something that looked closer to a pile of cinders. That's one of the things that I hope will really be focus on coming out of this report, something that we will be focused on in towns and cities and states throughout the region, is every city has to have a plan, every county has to have a plan, every state has to have a plan, and they need to be clear that poor people's lives are just as valuable as those of the rich.
Great. Thank you so much, Ben. Maybe just to kind of tie this together, I mean, I think that for all of us, the debate going on in Congress right now about climate change legislation is critically important, but I think the spirit of this report and the spirit of all of our comments has been really to focus us on how can we deal with the fact that climate change is real and immediate and happening now. We realize that that's the case in Africa and Asia and Latin America, but sometimes I think we forget about the fact that perhaps here in the United States as well we're going to have to make some adjustments to the way we live and how we care for our populations. And our own National Security Council and has identified climate change as a national security issue. So it, I think, behooves us to actually begin to develop the tools that will democratize the process of local and state-level planning for these kinds of emergencies. And I think at the heart of this report, in addition to the data it provides, is the methodology itself. It becomes a tool that community groups and county government and state government can use to really do the kind of planning that Ben has been referring to. So with that, let me open it up to members of the press. And our operator will, I think, jump in quickly and give you instructions as to how to get in the queue to ask any questions of various of us that have been on the line.
And at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. That's star and one to ask a question. Please keep in mind that you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, that's star and one to ask a question. Our first question will come from the site of Ben Evans from Associated Press. Your line is now open.
Yeah, hi, everybody. This is a question I think probably for Chris or maybe Ray. Does this study look at the Southeast compared to other regions of the country and whether, as a whole, the Southeast is more vulnerable than other areas of the country?
Chris, I'll defer to you on that one.
Sure, Ben, that's a great question. I think the choice of the Southeast was made primarily because when we think about hazards related to climate change, specifically the Hurricane Coast sea level rise, the Southeast has a smaller amount of elevation, so they're more highly impacted to sea level rise. This is obviously the Hurricane Coast. The Southeast, along with the Southwest, are both highly impacted by drought hazards. So I think that this area was chosen as a first look, and it was not compared to other areas in the country. But I believe that future research is going to point us in that direction.
Okay.
Chris, just I think one thing to add there is that this region is the poorest region of the nation, and therefore the area that's probably most in need of national help. We're talking about what more than three-quarters of the poorest counties in the country are in these 13 states.
Okay.
I'd also mention from the League of Women Voters standpoint that on our website, lwv.org, we have a brief summary paper on the impacts of global climate change in the Midwest that you might want to take a look at.
And this is Ray Offenheiser from Oxfam. One of the things I would also mention is that a year or two ago, Oxfam supported a study looking at poverty throughout the United States at the congressional district level called Measuring America, and it drilled down quite deeply into the issues of poverty and using the UN Human Development Report methodology. And what really struck us was precisely what Ben was saying about the levels of poverty across the Southeast United States. And subsequently, we've funded similar studies in Mississippi and Louisiana looking at these poverty questions at the county level. So we've been looking at the data in terms of poverty in this region for some time, and this, in some sense, study, you know, adds the other dimension here of vulnerability and climate change to work that's already been done. So you can locate those other studies also on our website.
You know, but Ben, this is Reverend Edwards. If I could also add to it, I think one of the things we miss is that even in the Gulf of Mexico, the number of petroleum companies that drill it and the effect that the climate change will have if we don't put a proper amount of coastal restoration protection, that the whole country will suffer for what's happening in the Southeast also.
Okay, thanks.
And it looks like our next question will come from the site of Brenton Mock of Root. Your line is now open.
I have two questions, if that's okay. The first has to do with the Fifth District Court ruling that came last week, I believe, October 16th, on behalf of Gulf Coast residents and farmers, I believe out of Biloxi. The court ruling said that these residents who filed a legal complaint against oil and gas companies for their heat-trapping emissions that they sent, which went on to cause the global warming conditions that led to causing Hurricane Katrina, the judge in that court ruled that they actually have legal standing to bring these lawsuits against oil and gas companies for their emissions based off of how Hurricane Katrina affected their livelihoods. And I'm wondering if you all are aware of this lawsuit and if or at least these legal complaints, and how this report will kind of complements or if it's associated at all with that legal complaint that was filed.
Well, I would just say this is Ray Offenheiser from Oxfam. I mean, I'm sure our staff in the region is aware of that particular case. I can't speak to it directly, although we have been sort of looking at the whole question of, you know, the presence of oil and gas companies in the region and the impacts, the environmental impacts on the sort of coastal on the coastal zone where, you know, there's been a lot of canals dredged and much of the sort of wetlands areas of that coastal area have been compromised, which actually has made the impacts of both Katrina and Rita storms considerably worse. And I think Reverend Tyrone was speaking to that earlier about the need to really think carefully about the preservation of coastal wetlands and their restoration and the investment in that as part of addressing some of these vulnerability questions for climate change. In terms of the specifics of that case, I don't know. Ben, did you is the NAACP following that at all?
I mean, I think what I say is that, you know, both that case and this report draw the connection between environmental vulnerability and human vulnerability in this country. I mean, it's a conversation that we're used to having about Nigeria or Colombia or, you know, but that we typically don't have about South Carolina or Georgia or the Gulf Coast. And we have to have those conversations here because the reality is that whether you're a farmer, whether you're live in a rural area or just a working neighborhood in a big city, that people who are sort of closest to the bottom of our economy are most connected to the environment, and we have to draw those connections here, or we will never be able to completely heal from these hurricanes. We'll just face more and more, and we won't get out in front of the problem. Did you have a second question you were going to pose?
Yeah, one other question is the Center for Biological Diversity also put out a report recently about drought in the Southeast, and they made an argument that that the issues of drought are more typically related to overpopulation as opposed to anything else. I'm just wondering if the authors of the report have any thoughts, insight, or position on the impact of population itself on drought.
Chris, do you want to take that?
Drought in particular.
Sure, I can try to talk a little bit to that. I think when we're dealing with drought, drought is a very difficult hazard to identify. We have different types of drought, agricultural drought, where the plants that we need to survive and grow crops aren't getting enough water. We have meteorologic drought, where we have less rain than normal, which might coincide with agricultural drought. And then we have surface water drought. And I think that the authors of the report, from the biological diversity standpoint, probably were looking at the idea of a drought of surface water, or the fact that human populations are taking more and more surface water and basically flushing it down the toilet. Now, unfortunately, I haven't read this report, but I would think that depending on how you look at drought, humans, of course, would have a huge influence on drought.
And it appears that we have no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the call back over to Mr. Offenheiser for any closing remarks.
Great. Well, again, I'd like to thank the members of the press and our commentators for joining us this morning. I think it's been a lively discussion. And we encourage members of the press to read the report, review the maps, and that are available on Oxfam America's website at www.oxfamamerica.com/adapt, and they will remain on the website for the foreseeable future. Again, we're in a period where climate change legislation is top of mind and a major priority for the administration, and I think for citizens of the country, there's considerable support for it. But I think we need to remember that not only is climate change about carbon sequestration and improving the levels of carbon in our atmosphere, it's also about the livelihoods of people on the ground, not only in Africa and Asia, but here at home in the United States. And we need to accelerate the work that we're doing on planning at the local, state, and national level if we're going to be able to adapt to the challenges that will be posed by climate change over the next two decades. And the sooner we begin that work, probably the more affordable it will be and the easier it will be for us to manage. So that I'd like to congratulate the authors of the report, who I think have done a great job in sort of highlighting a way forward and trying to provide evidence that we can use to think about these issues in a practical, hands-on way. And I understand they're doing more work at the county at the county level that will enable local leaders to take advantage of this, and citizen groups as well, to create the space for dialogue about what's needed to be done and what investments need to be made. So with that, again, I'd like to thank everyone that's been on the call, and hope you will review the report and forward any questions to us. We'll be happy to respond to them. Thank you all very, very much.